WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, two Golden Globe nominees. First, Helen Mirren tells us about her acting career. She's nominated for three Golden Globes, for Elizabeth I in Prime Suspect on TV, and for her performance as Elizabeth II in the film The Queen. Then we hear from Alec Baldwin. He plays an executive on the NBC comedy series 30 Rock. Baldwin's also in the spy movie The Good Shepherd, which is now in theaters. TV critic David Bianculli previews three shows with season premieres this Sunday. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new CDs from former American Idol stars. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Monday could be a big day for actress Helen Mirren. She's up for 3 Golden Globe Awards. 2 are for her portrayals of British monarchy, Elizabeth I in an HBO miniseries, and Elizabeth II in the film The Queen. The 3rd nomination is for her role as Detective Jane Tennyson in last season's episodes of the BBC mystery series Prime Suspect. Helen Mirren was introduced to many American viewers 15 years ago when she played Tennyson in the first Prime Suspect series. She has a long list of other stage, screen, and television credits and earned Oscar nominations for Best Supporting Actress for her performances in The Madness of King George and Gosford Park. Here's a clip from her film The Queen, directed by Stephen Frears. In this scene, Princess Diana has just been killed, and the Queen, played by Mirren, is on the phone with British Prime Minister Tony Blair.
Coming down to London at the earliest opportunity.
It would be a great comfort to your people.
And would help them with their grief.
Their grief? If you imagine I'm going to drop everything and come down to London before I attend to my grandchildren who've just lost their mother, then you're mistaken. I doubt there is anyone who knows the British people more than I do, Mr. Blair, nor who has greater faith in their wisdom and judgment. And it is my belief that they will any moment reject this mood, which is being stirred up by the press, in favor of a period of restrained grief and sober private mourning. That's the way we do things in this country, quietly. With dignity. It's what the rest of the world has always admired us for.
I spoke to Mirren last year when she played a 16th century monarch, the temperamental and passionate Elizabeth I, in the HBO miniseries.
Well, gentlemen, I've come to hear you talk, and I trust you will watch me while I listen.
Your Majesty, we beg to raise the question of your marriage.
Well, so long as you do not come to me to complain about your wives, I am content.
Well, Helen Mirren, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Can you think of anything in the reading that you did about Elizabeth that you thought gave you some, you know, emotional insight into this woman?
I think one thing in particular really affected me was reading that at one point she was so angry she actually passed out.
Really?
Yes. And I thought, wow, that's like really angry. I can't imagine being so angry that you literally pass out. And then, you know, you really got the, I got the impression of an incredibly tempestuous, emotional woman where she was unafraid of her own emotions. She had no reason to be afraid of them. She could let them loose because she was a queen. She could do anything. She could cry, she could scream, she could throw shoes, she could shut herself away, she could, really play up, you know, as far as she wanted to without any kind of censure, really.
Well, I thought we should listen to a clip from Queen Elizabeth I in which you play the monarch. And the one I thought we would hear is where you, as Queen Elizabeth, learned that the Earl of Leicester, whom the Queen has had a long-running affair or flirtation with, she's learned that he is actually secretly married. He is played here by Jeremy Irons. And, of course, my guest, Helen Mirren, Elizabeth I. Let's hear her discover that her friend is actually married.
Oh, you son of a whore.
Your Majesty, you must know that...
Know what, my lord?
That I would never have taken a wife. If there were but a chance, you would smile upon my suit.
I never wish to see your face again.
My heart still runs on you, I swear it.
Be off before I hang you. I'm minded to hang you now, with my own hands too.
Bess.
Get out of my sight! We forbid you access to our presence. You are no longer welcome at our court. Be gone, sir. Now.
You know, what's interesting about listening to that scene is that we hear the Queen, when she loses control, actually use the word I in public, refer to herself in the first person singular, and then she realizes it, composes herself, and begins speaking in the royal we. You are no longer yes. welcome in our presence. Did you sort of have to become comfortable with a public and a private Elizabeth in developing this character?
Yes. I mean, that's very much what our piece is about, is the public versus and intertwined with the private. It's very difficult to go behind the velvet curtains or the heavy oak doors of history, you know, and find out what that person was actually like in private, because obviously so much of what we read is very much either through contemporary writing that's flattering, highly flattering. No one quite, you know, certainly you wouldn't dare criticize the Queen.
You know, one of the things about doing it, portraying a 16th century queen, is you wear a lot of stuff.
I mean,
stuff in your hair.
Couldn't be enough for me, I tell you.
Yeah, you like that.
I loved all of that. Oh, I loved it. Yes, it's great.
Well, I read that. Did you also wear contact lenses to tint your eyes?
Yes, I did. I noticed when I looked at all the portraits, that her eyes were always very black, very dark. And although it was very fashionable to have white skin, the only descriptions that I could find of her that were maybe truthful actually described her as having rather sallow skin. So she wasn't this white-skinned, red, you know, rosy-cheeked person at all. She was, her red hair was natural. And then one of the ambassadors described her as having black eyes. And I thought this black-eyed look, which is very piercing, it's quite intimidating. If you know anyone with very dark, dark brown eyes, you know, it's quite a piercing, intimidating look it gives to their eyes. I thought that would be quite a good tool. So I thought he's probably historically accurate. So yes, I wore dark brown lenses.
Now, of course, it's interesting that in addition to this portrayal of Elizabeth I, you play Elizabeth II, right, the current queen. How would you compare the two? Is there any connection?
There's a big connection, you know. It was very interesting. Such completely different personalities. You couldn't get more extreme differences in personality. The Elizabeth I, very not governed by her emotions, far from it. She was governed by her sense of power and her sense of autocracy, but a much more emotional person. And this present queen, who's governed by an overriding sense of self-discipline, duty, and sacrifice. But the thing that they absolutely have in common is this single-minded dedication and desire to be who they are. And I think they share that absolutely. And it's what makes both of them, I think, very mighty monarchs. And I think Elizabeth II will, as history travels on, will be looked back on as a very, very iconic and important figure in British history.
We're speaking with actress Helen Mirren. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Helen Mirren. She's nominated for 3 Golden Globe Awards for her roles in The Queen, Prime Suspect, and Elizabeth I. You went into films in your 20s, late 20s. And then in the 70s, I read you sort of took a hiatus from a traditional acting course and joined Peter Brook's Experimental International Center of Theater Research, which involved, touring Africa and parts of the United States, performing in very small settings, California farm workers.
It says Chavez, in fact.
Right. What appealed to you about that?
It worked.
And then what did you get from that experience?
Well, you know, it was a part of my sort of my search, my holy grail, to try and be better. And having done a lot of Shakespeare in a very formal, in that formal theatre environment, I felt it was time to throw everything up in the air. And I was lucky enough to be around when Brooke was just beginning that particular period of his life's work. And I joined for 1 year. So, yes, we travelled through Africa. We started in Algeria and went down to Nigeria, south of Nigeria, and then back up again, travelling in jeeps and working in just very, very small villages, never in any towns. And then we came to America and we worked with the Teatro Campesino and with other theatre groups in America.
Was this for you more a matter of developing your acting craft, and or was it a matter of personal or political growth?
Not political. So it was apolitical. I mean, I think it was personal. Yes, personal acting growth. Not personal growth as a person. Although, of course, it turned into a bit of that as well, because when you're challenged like that, and it was very, very challenging, difficult work, you are, you know, you do have to make some sort of personal growth, which I'm still in the process of learning from that experience now. But it was very much to discover other ways of acting. I don't know whether that I really actually learned anything in reality, except for conquering fear, maybe.
I wanted to talk about another film for which you received a Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actress. That's Gosford Park, a film I don't know well because I've only seen it twice. It's wonderfully complex.
You've only seen it twice?
Yes, I've only seen it twice.
I know what you mean about that's the nature of Altman's movies, isn't it? Yes.
Right. There's so much happening that never quite get it all. I mean, this is one in which there's, a weekend party in a British estate in the 1930s. And the wonderful thing is that we see the world of the affluent, the middle class people, and then also below stairs their servants, which you occupy in this case. And I wanted to thought we would listen to a clip from the film. This is just to explain what's happening here. In this, you play the housekeeper of a wealthy man, Lord William Stockbridge, who hosts this party, and is actually murdered in the course of it. And it turns out that when your character, Mrs. Wilson, was a young girl, she was one of many servants whom Stockbridge had sexually preyed upon. She bore a son which had been sent away to an orphanage, but which now many years later turns out returns to the estate as a valet of one of the guests. He recognizes his father and decides he's going to kill this man who had abandoned him. But your character, Mrs. Wilson, sees this coming and instead poisons Stockbridge first, so her son, in fact, can't be accused of killing him. And the scene we're going to play here is a memorable one in which you are discussing this with another servant, played by Kelly MacDonald. Let's listen.
But even if Robert is your son, how did you know that he meant to harm his father?
What gift do you think a good servant has that separates them from the others? It's the gift of anticipation. And I'm a good servant. I'm better than good. I'm the best. I'm the perfect servant. I know when they'll be hungry and the food is ready. I know when they'll be tired and the bed is turned down. I know it before they know it themselves.
Are you going to tell them?
Why? What purpose would it possibly serve?
What if they find out what happened?
Not much for crime to stab a dead man, is it? They can never touch him. That's what's important, his life.
And your life?
Didn't you hear me? I'm the perfect servant. I have no life.
And that's our guest, Helen Mirren, in the film Gosford Park. She's speaking there with Kelly MacDonald. A wonderful scene. I wonder if you could tell us a little about making that.
Yeah, it's a lovely piece of writing.
Well, that's what's interesting, I think. You know, a lot of actors love to be with Altman because, I mean, his reputation is that of a lot of improvising and free-flowing. I mean, this is... You've come from, you know, performing a lot of Shakespeare. What was it like to work with Altman?
It's a bit of a misnomer, really, that, you know, Altman is all about improvisation. That's not actually true. He choreographs very precisely. You know, he loves the text, and the text is important. But what he does do is he has everybody mic'd all the time. And so as important as the visual story is the sound story in an Altman movie. And because you're mic'd, everything you say, and sometimes you do improvise it, all actors do, you know, those little moments of improvisation can be used. And then, of course, the way he shoots is very extraordinary, and it creates this improvisational look to the movie. But in reality, it's very, very carefully choreographed and very precise, in fact. That was my experience, anyway.
Yeah. What do you mean by the way he shoots, creating that feel?
Well, I mean, it's a sort of technical thing, but for example, he very often shoots with two cameras, and the two cameras are often moving simultaneously, which is sort of unheard of on you know, when you're shooting a movie. And you'll never know if you're in close-up or if you're in a wide shot or if it's a mid-shot while you're playing the scene. You don't know what kind of shot you're in. So you can't become conscious in that particular way. It's a particular kind of technique. That's very visually, it creates a sort of rather extraordinary thing, and also for the actors, you play it almost like a play. You play the whole scene through, not quite knowing when you're on camera, if you're off camera, if you're in close up. So it's very individual, and I loved the way he worked. I thought it's amazing.
Well, Helen Mirren, in 1991, you had a role with which you've become much identified when you played Jane Tennyson in the Prime Suspect series. I thought we'd hear a little bit of the first Prime Suspect series, and this one is one in which you have been a district chief inspector. That's the rank where you should be able to handle a murder investigation, but the men in the department have found ways not to let you actually get an investigation to cover. And in this case, one person who has begun a major investigation, one of the officers has died, and you've come in to assert your right to get involved in this major police work.
This may not be the right time, sir, but under the circumstances, I'm not quite sure when would be the right time. I'm offering to take over the murder investigation. I don't have to tell you that I am qualified to handle this investigation, and that I have been waiting for... Well, I don't have to tell you how long. 18 months. And in that time, I've had to handle more paperwork than I did at Reading for my whole 5 years dealing with sex cases. I know DCI Shefford was at a crucial stage of the investigation.
I have to see his wife this afternoon. Don't expect me to make any decisions now. This is not the right time.
Well, when is the right time? Look, I am the only officer of my rank who's continually overstepped, sidestepped, whatever. Just give me the chance to prove that I can.
You don't have to prove yourself to me. Let me think about it.
Well, that's not enough, Michael. I'm getting sick to death of this so-called Metropolitan Police Survey being thrown at me. So, all right, apparently 90% of the time the general public would prefer a male officer. But until one of us gets a chance to prove that that survey is a biased, outdated load of
old... A man who I respected highly died right there. And now, Inspector, is not the time to thrust your women's rights down my throat. I'll get back to you.
Thank you, sir.
That was my guest Helen Mirren playing Jane Tennyson in the original Prime Suspect series. Acting in that scene with her was John Benfield. You know, a lot of the fans of that series, me included, could hardly imagine anybody but you in that role. Did it seem like a perfect fit when you read it?
I don't know about that. I mean, I did recognize that I was jolly lucky to have it, you know, because it's so rare, even to this day, incidentally, that a woman drives the narrative of a drama. You can have very good female roles and things, but rarely are they actually driving the narrative. And then it was even less likely, especially on television or anywhere. So you know, that was what fascinated me, the fact that it was a female character driving the narrative. The fact it was a police thing and Jane Tennyson and all the rest of it didn't really impinge upon my consciousness. I just saw that it was a, you know, really a lovely, complex role.
Did you learn any gestures or vocal mechanisms that you put into that character? Do you recall?
The only thing was that I, you know, a policewoman who was quite high up, said she never folds her arms. I thought that was a very interesting. You know, police are very, very into body language. They can read you like a book. The good detectives, they understand body language extremely well. It's how they do their job a lot of the time. And she said, don't fold your arms. Because folding your arms is, it looks, you think you're being strong. And I laugh now. I often see, you know, there's big posters of women playing police women. And they've always standing there with their arms folded, thinking, oh, this looks powerful and strong. Not, you know, folding your arms is a defensive action. And much more powerful is to stand with your arms relaxed by your side, open, you know, ready.
Well, Helen Mirren, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much.
Helen Mirren. She's nominated for Golden Globe Awards for her television roles in Prime Suspect and Elizabeth I and the feature film The Queen. I spoke to her last year. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Ovid's The Metamorphoses, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. And from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting The Illusionist, starring Edward Norton, Paul Giamatti, and Jessica Biel, now on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Alec Baldwin is nominated for a Golden Globe. He plays a wisecracking TV exec on 30 Rock. Also, David Bean Cooley previews three TV shows that begin new seasons this weekend. And the new season of American Idol is coming up. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews CDs from four Idol stars. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The new season of TV's American Idol starts on Tuesday, but four previous Idol stars, Taylor Hicks, Fantasia Barrino, Kelly Pickler, and Chris Daughtry, have all put out albums within weeks of each other. Rock critic Ken Tucker says their styles vary widely, but that quality control is a common problem.
But you say that you're calling, you don't, and I'm spinning my That's Kelly Pickler, the American Idol finalist who seemed to enjoy playing the role of ditzy blonde during her appearances on this country's most popular talent show. For her major label debut, the North Carolina native has turned out a country album that's completely respectable by the current standards of the Nashville industry. Which is to say, if you think acts like Rascal Flatts and Sugarland are making country music as opposed to twangy pop, you'll like Kelly Pickler well enough. The song I played at the start of this review, Red High Heels, is a top 10 country hit, and her album, Small Town Girl, fits the American Idol template. Emphasize your humble roots, suggest heartache without ever veering into despair or agony. By contrast, aching hard rock, not country, is the genre for Chris Daughtry, the Idol finalist who fronts a band called Daughtry. Like Pickler, Daughtry sidles up to real feelings without actually tapping into them. Unlike her, he likes to yell about this situation rather than croon about it.
I was blown away, what could I say? It all seemed to make sense. You're taking away everything, and I can't deal with that. I try to see the good in life, but good things in life are hard to find.
That's Chris Daughtry, sounding, unfortunately, like 57 other generic hard rockers. The American Idol conundrum is this. A contestant emerges from the TV series with a built-in audience that gives him or her an enormous advantage over any other new artist in the marketplace. But what the TV fans want is for you to retain the same persona you presented to them on the show, which is usually some variation on the humble novice. But to prove you're a legitimate artist, you have to demonstrate expertise. You have to veer off the middle of the road that made you appeal to the broadest range of people with cell phones who'll vote you to become the American Idol. Some can maneuver this tightrope. Carrie Underwood, for example, has sold millions of country pop tunes and won all sorts of country awards. And then there's Clay Aiken, the hero of some teeny boppers and grandparents, and now known mostly for getting into a public spat with TV host Kelly Ripa. What can I say? It's a tough gig. One of the few idols who's made artistically challenging and satisfying music is Fantasia Barrino. On her new album, she works with Big Boy from Outkast to perform a solid chunk of hip-hop called Hood Boy. Finally, there's this past season's winner, Taylor Hicks. The prematurely white-haired leader of fans who've been dubbed the Soul Patrol, his audience responds to his raspy voice because that sound has a place in rock history, even if you're too young to know who Joe Cocker or Tom Waits or Ray Charles is. Raspy white boy funk is not Hicks's shtick. It's what he knows, and it's what is packaged neatly on his self-titled debut.
It's a whole new education. I'm learning from you all the time. There's no need for explanation. Your examples do just fine. I'm getting I'm
one around.
Unfortunately for Hicks, the kind of soul music he's drawn to is better communicated with more furtiveness or frustration or anger or lust. None of these qualities behooves a freshly minted American Idol. Maybe after some of that luster is tarnished a bit, he'll make another record that'll dig deeper within himself and go to emotional places where the soul cannot be patrolled.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. Coming up, a conversation with Alec Baldwin. This is Fresh Air. Actor Alec Baldwin is nominated for a Golden Globe Award for his role in the NBC comedy 30 Rock, in which he plays a studio executive in charge of a sketch comedy show something like Saturday Night Live. Washington Post TV critic Tom Shales called Baldwin's performance rare and rich, saying he avoids doing the easy thing, which would be playing the executive as a clueless doofus. Here's a clip from the show.
Are you familiar with the GE Triduction Oven?
I don't cook very much.
Sure. I got you. New York, third wave feminist, college educated, single and pretending to be happy about it, overscheduled, undersexed. You buy any magazine that says healthy body image on the cover, and every 2 years you take up knitting for a week.
That is dead on.
What, are you going to guess my weight now?
You don't want me to do that.
Baldwin has had a long and successful Hollywood career, starring in such films as The Hunt for Red October, Glengarry Glen Ross, The Getaway, Miami Blues, and Pearl Harbor. Terry spoke to Alec Baldwin in 2003. He told her about the days when he first got to New York City. While he was studying acting at NYU, he was also a waiter at Studio 54.
By the time I worked there in the fall of 1979, it was all over. You know, no one was really going there anymore. I mean, there might be some people would roll in late at night to just as a pit stop from some other place they were going that was now more, favored. But when I worked there, it was very funny because I just, I was like Jim Nabors. You know, I was like Gomer Pyle. And I'm working at this big disco with all these people. And I go up into the balcony and some older guy in a beautiful suit would walk up to me and hand me a $100 bill and say, I want you to go to the deli on 8th Avenue and get me a box of Benson and Hedges in a box. And I want you to get me a lemonade and I want you to get me, and he had like, he had his menu of exactly what he had to have. And it said, I want you to go get that for me and come back and meet me and Enrique up here, my boyfriend. And I'm going to, do something nice for you. Okay, run. And I was like, so nice of you to ask me to do this for you. Trot off, come back. The guy would give you like $50 and a tip because he wanted to stay up there and, get it on with Enrique in the balcony all night. Just make sure that my Brandy Alexanders keep coming. And it was just so bizarre to me because this was my introduction to all the exotic birds of Manhattan.
When you started your career, you were, among other things, the young hunk. And I think we know more about how, beautiful actresses, the predicaments they're in and how they're marketed when they're young. We know more about that than we do about, like, the young leading men. What were some of the expectations of you early in your career, as the young hunk?
Well, God, what I wouldn't give to be the young hunk again. It was so much easier. But for me, I think my early sense of what was good about this business was more theater directed than film directed. The first job I did was a soap opera here in New York. And I remember I was on a cast of a daytime soap with a cast where at any given time, 3 or 4 or 5 people were in a Broadway show at the same time. And that was how I kind of got birthed into the business, was surrounded by those people who said the theater was really the only place that you can be satisfied, as an actor.
Well, that soap opera that you were on was called The Doctors. And, you know, I was wondering if being on a daytime soap early in your career helped you or hurt you, in the sense that a lot of people, you know, look down on daytime soaps and think that the acting isn't the best and that good acting isn't even particularly encouraged on it. So, you know, that kind of thing might be held against you. People might almost, you know, snicker at a starring role in a daytime soap. On the other hand, some actors say it's just the greatest experience.
Well, I think, you know, it's a variety of things. One, people don't really understand the dynamic of daytime TV, which is that it evolved from radio. And early daytime television up through the 60s and even the 70s was predicated on the same formula, which is you wanted to turn the TV on Monday. And if you turn the TV on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, we hadn't really proceeded too far from Monday. You know, if you missed the show on Tuesday and Wednesday, when you came back on Thursday, you could pick up right where you left off.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, every Friday program was where we restated all the facts of what had evolved during the week. So I'd say, you know, Terry, I really am glad that you have taken over Palmer Industries now and that you have and that you and Jed are reconciling your divorce. And, you know, there was like a recap and there's a mechanism to it, which is very artificial, but it was about an audience that is a kind of a come and go audience, you know. And for me, it was a great experience.
I thought we could listen to one of your great movie scenes, and this is from the movie Glengarry Glen Ross, which is based on a David Mamet play. The movie is about salesmen who are selling this worthless land, but they have to make it seem like this land is really great and you're getting a really great deal. So the people who they sell to are mostly these real, like, naive losers. So you play the manager who's sent in from the main office to light a fire under these guys and to get them to, like, to keep selling. I'm going to play part of your monologue.
As we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest, as you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize, a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired. You get the picture? You laughing now? You got leads. Mitch and Murray paid good money. Get their names to sell them. You can't close the leads you're given. You can't close. You are. Hit the bricks, pal, and beat it, because you are going out.
The leads are weak.
The leads are weak. The leads are weak. You're weak. I've been in this business 15 years.
What's your name?
You, that's my name. You know why, mister? Because you drove a Hyundai to get here tonight. I drove an $80,000 BMW. That's my name. And your name is your wanting. And you can't play in the man's game. You can't close them. Then go home and tell your wife your troubles. Because only one thing counts in this life. Get them to sign on the line which is dotted. You hear me, you faggots?
That's my guest, Alec Baldwin, in a scene from Glengarry Glen Ross. That scene must have been so much fun to do because, well, the writing is so good. Can you describe a little bit your approach to learning and digesting that really pretty long monologue and figuring out, like, how you want to pace yourself in it, where the pauses are going to be, what, how dramatic to get?
Well, you know, the doing that film was interesting because the role that I played was not in the play. And Mamet had added that role to the screenplay for the movie because he felt that they needed to be, we needed to see the stakes raised a little higher at the onset of the film. So he added this scene and we went in there and it was an enormously difficult and unpleasant thing for me to have to do because here were these actors who I loved, Kevin and Jack and Ed and Ark, and I had to go in and really just kind of pee all over them. You know, it was just this horrible scene, you know, in terms of if you did it right, you know, you didn't want to back off. And I just didn't want to do that. You know, they were all getting along so well and all had a great time shooting together. And I walked in to shoot the scene for just 2.5 or 3 days, and because we rehearsed a full rehearsal period prior to the shooting, which is very rare. And so we did that, and, you know, you could tell it was going to be really tough, you know, because, I mean, I was just, I had to be so nasty to these people. And I left, and, you know, I came back, and they started shooting for a couple of weeks. And it was one of those things where you come to work and they're all sitting around the coffee urn and eating a bagel and laughing and having a good time. And I walk in and they're like, oh, you know, Schmucko is here, you know. And I come in and I got to, you know, they know what's coming, which is I got to just kind of singe their hair all day. But I guess my point is that doing those really tough scenes is not fun. You know, it really isn't fun because to be that person, you know, when you play Hitler or you play Ted Bundy or anybody you play, it's challenging, but it's not really fun. You know, I did Streetcar Named Desire on Broadway quite a while ago, and my friends would come up to me, particularly younger guys, and they'd say, boy, it must be so much fun for you to get up there on stage and get all that out of your system every day. And I said, you know, back then I was 34 years old in 1992, and I said, I realized a couple of weeks into the run of the show that I don't have that much in my system to begin with. And that around the second month of the run, I almost wanted to put my arms around Blanche and say, hey, Blanche, why don't you and I sit down and have a drink and try to work this out? You know, let's be friends. And so all of that contentiousness and all of that kind of drama with people, it does wear you out after a while.
Alec Baldwin, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Alec Baldwin speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. Baldwin is nominated for a Golden Globe Award for his role in the NBC comedy 30 Rock. Coming up, David Bianculli on three TV shows that begin new seasons this Sunday. This is Fresh Air. This weekend, three television series return that have our TV critic David Bianculli pulling out his positive adjectives, but for very different reasons. Here are his reviews of HBO's Extras and Rome and the Fox series 24, all of which kick off new seasons Sunday night.
Three excellent series returning to TV this weekend, 24, Extras, and Rome, offer very different viewing experiences. Extras stars and is co-created by Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant, who concocted the original British version of The Office. Gervais plays a struggling actor who, in this new season, tastes fame as a character on a popular but bland sitcom, but doesn't much like the taste. Extras is a show that makes great use of guest stars, like David Bowie and Diana Rigg, who poke fun at their own images, and is the sort of subtle comedy that rewards repeated viewing. Here's Gervais as actor Andy Millman, a former movie extra whose sitcom script is being produced, with him as one of the leads. Yet when his ineffectual agent, played by Merchant, visits him on the set, Andy isn't happy. But his agent has a solution, in the form of another client, played by Sean Williamson.
Hey, buddy. All right. How's it going? All set?
I'm not sure I'm doing the right thing.
No?
This is not the comedy I set out to do. I wanted to write something real that people would relate to, and it's all changed because people have stuck their nose in.
Yeah, I'm hearing you, all right, but do you know what? This is typical first night nerves, all right? I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, oh, the script's not funny, you know, it's crass, it's lowest common denominator. And, you know, you're right, but don't worry about it, because people will watch anything, all right? Particularly if it's on after EastEnders and they've got to change the channel. Those sort of morons will help us win the ratings war. And, you know, ratings in the end are what count, and merchandise.
Well, it's not accounts for me, all right? I wanted to write a good, credible comedy that would stand the test of time.
Yeah, no, okay. Well, I agree, and I was just saying that because that's what I thought you wanted me to say.
Well, don't. Tell the truth.
Well, I will, and the truth is, if you're not happy, I'm right behind you.
Right.
And, you know, I've got the perfect replacement.
For what?
For you, for your character. It's only Barry.
All right, Sean.
He's all set, knows all the lines, he's ready to go. He can step in. What's your character's catchphrase?
It's not a catchphrase. It's some of the real ways to actually say.
What was it?
You having a laugh? Is he having a laugh?
Look at that, nothing. Stony face, and I love a giggle, me. I love a laugh, don't I? You do it.
Are you having a laugh? Is he having a laugh?
It's good, I don't know how he comes up with it.
He didn't come up with it?
Yeah. The thing about Barry is, and I've noticed this, right, people will laugh at him, they never laugh with him. It's extraordinary. Look at that face. A sort of undercurrent of tragedy to it, isn't there? Do it.
Are you having a laugh? Is he having a laugh?
I love it because he's desperate.
Yeah, the role's taken. Cheers.
The HBO program returning immediately before Extras this weekend, also beginning its second season, is Rome. This series got off to a slow start dramatically, but by the end of the first 12 episodes, and the assassination of Julius Caesar in the Senate, it had become the most gripping toga drama since I, Claudius. Okay, so there haven't been that many. But HBO's last new drama, Carnival, started going nowhere fast and ended up going nowhere very slowly. Rome, by contrast, has picked up pace and focus, and this second season is all about the transfer of power. Some characters remain calm and crafty, while others around them lose their heads, literally. Rome isn't as satisfying, or as deeply original and unforgettable, as HBO's Deadwood or The Wire, but few TV shows are. Yet Rome has matured into a strong drama series, and its period setting makes it unique in today's crowded but derivative television landscape. Finally, also beginning on Sunday, is the new season of 24 on Fox, with Kiefer Sutherland returning as counterterrorist unit agent Jack Bauer. The story picks up 20 months after last season's cliffhanger, when Jack saved the world, again, only to be arrested and carted away by agents of the Chinese government. This time, the U.S. is suffering a series of terrorist attacks by suicide bombers from Atlanta to Los Angeles, and CTU agent Chloe, one of Jack's few remaining loyal contacts, is given some puzzling marching orders. She checks with Nadia, her new boss.
Nadia, I just got a weird request from Homeland Security. They want to set up a channel, and I wanted to clear it with you first.
Consider yourself clear.
They want it formatted according to military specs.
Coordinating assault with the Cobra attack helicopters from Camp Pendleton.
When?
30 minutes.
But assault on who?
Assad.
What are you talking about? We don't even know where Assad is.
We will. We have a lead.
No, we don't. If we did, I would know about it.
We found a way to get Assad's location.
How?
Jack Bauer.
Jack's in a Chinese prison.
Not anymore. The president negotiated his release 2 days ago.
Jack's coming back?
Yes.
Well, why did the Chinese let him go? Why today? Does this have something to do with the attacks? How do we think Jack's going to lead us to Assad?
Chloe, I can't talk about this. Not yet.
I won't spoil any surprises, but the first 4 hours of this year's 24, shown Sunday and Monday night in two-hour blocks, contain at least two jaw-dropping moments and at least one significant death. Once again, 24 hits the ground running and never takes a breath, or lets you take one, except during the commercials. I'd like to take a moment, though, to salute all three of these series for something that's not often discussed, the way they're scheduled. In Extras, Ricky Gervais plays a character who talks about making a sitcom for the ages, one that's good enough to hold up. In real life, he's already done that with The Office, and now with Extras. And he's done it, in part, by using the same approach John Cleese took when making the classic comedy Fawlty Towers 30 years ago. Cleese made 6 episodes, then stopped for a bit, made a second season of 6 more, and packed it in. For The Office, Gervais made 12 episodes over 2 seasons, and a 2-part special, and called it quits, leaving behind one of TV's best modern comedies. He plans the same sort of finish for Extras. Sometimes, especially in TV, less really is more. Rome, too, is on a shorter schedule than the 22 episodes normally churned out by the broadcast networks. It presents 12 episodes a year and shows them without interruption or preemption. 24, of course, is the broadcast model that succeeds where so few have dared to try. It presents 24 episodes, so its season is even longer than the average broadcast series. But it doesn't start rolling them out until January, so it can run them all without taking a hiatus or filling time with a rerun. For a show with the dramatic momentum of 24, that's crucial, and scheduling it in such a viewer-friendly way is brilliant. And if you don't think that's so important, ask yourself, when's the last time you thought about Lost, which has been on hiatus since November?
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. From 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting The Illusionist, starring Edward Norton, Paul Giamatti, and Jessica Biel, now on DVD. And from Patricia Papper for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
There are 1,300 of God's children here suffering, sometimes going hungry.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Michael Honey about the campaign Martin Luther King was working on when he was assassinated, a general strike in support of Memphis sanitation workers. Join us for the next Fresh Air.